you know, you always remember your first, you know, dead body, your first murder scene, this type of stuff, you know. You know, the crime scene tape at some of these scenes where you see the people in the white suits, but you mightn't necessarily know what goes on. Oh, you should see my internet search history. It's unbelievable.
I actually think the guards would be called if you looked at my search history sometime. He probably has their whole 10-year plan.
Yeah, he might have a hole dug out the back too. Like,
oh,
you know.
God! Oh, God!
Welcome back to How My Drink. I am just reading, it's 199 episodes.
Oh, my God,
we're
is
one
it?
One way from 200, guys.
What the hell?
What? That's mad.
That's scary, isn't
that's
it?
That's insane.
How have we talked?
Oh, I also can't believe it's nearly Christmas.
Four Mondays. Can't be, is
five
it?
5 weeks. It's 17th today.
Four or five weeks.
Yeah.
God. Guys, I'm skinned. It's going to be a very dry Christmas, okay? If any of my family are listening, you're all getting nothing. Nada.
Bag of cold.
Yeah, absolutely nothing.
We were in Pennies. We were in London with Pennies.
We were.
Over the week.
Too much fun.
Last week, so good. Pennies shirts always are.
We've said that since we've started going on them, I think. And this is not to knock any other brand, but the penny strips are just iconic.
So much fun.
I think it's just a group of people that we go with as well. We just know that we all get along so well and we're just going to have a ball.
Yeah. That's the one thing about, because people always say that to us who aren't from Ireland, who are in our industry. They're like, are you friends from like school? And we're like, no. Like, they're like, the way you talk to each other and like how much you know about each other's lives and all. Like, they're like, you think he's your friend's ears. Like, it is a really nice, like, atmosphere.
Yeah.
Like, everyone's lovely.
It's always the best.
Yeah. But I think we all just actually get on.
Mm. Genuinely, we actually do. Yeah. So we always have so much fun.
It was so good.
It was a ball.
So many cucumber margaritas. Oh. I had the worst hangover of my actual life.
Oh, I definitely did as well.
Oh, my God.
And then
God.
I had to go on the tube in London. Grand. Oh, add that in God. On top. Not good. Couldn't stop vomiting.
I went to birth. I actually couldn't stop vomiting on the weekend. On Saturday, I was out and the bar we were in, the women's toilets stunk. Like, and it's not even like someone pooed. It was like sewerage. It was like there was something wrong with the pipes. There has to have been, because every time I went in, I'd get sick because the smell. Yeah.
Was that
I think I'm quite sensitive to smells.
Are you?
But I also was quite drunk, and then it was just sending me over the edge. Whatever like the smell was.
A bad smell would make you gag, kind of thing?
Yeah.
Would it?
But it was making me wretch.
How are you eating that stuff at the London?
Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
But the sea urchin was so nice.
It actually did look lovely.
It was really so fresh.
It did look good.
Yeah. It was really so nice. Wow. I looked like ass, and the man at the sea urchin stand was like, "Here you go, beautiful." I was like, "Please, spare me."
You could never look like ass.
I was dragged. I looked like a tractor brush. And then I seen him later on. He's like, "How's the urchin?" I was like, "Good."
How's the urchin?
Oh, he had like tattoos on his face and all.
Oh,
I was like, I'm definitely not your target. Audience. I'm a person. You'd be into me one bit. But it was really nice. But then we did like a little mini food crawl in the Borough Market. But it's really good to go if you're going to it. Because I went before on a weekend. Hell.
Yeah,
you can't see the floor. It felt weird being able to see the ground and see around me and see what was there.
I remember the last time I was there, I was just highly overstimulated. I was like, I don't even want to try anything because it's just too much going on here.
Well, we went at 4 o'clock on a Tuesday. It closed at 5. So no one was there. And we had chocolate strawberries, lemon butter pasta, and sea urchin.
I just want the oysters out there. I've seen videos of people getting oysters and they're literally like this big. It's like
That's the same stand.
Is it?
They
hold an oyster with two hands.
They have them. And the sea urchin was so nice.
Was it?
They just crack them open. Like you find them at the bottom of the sea and they have loads of spikes in them. It's
delicious.
Things that people step on. And then they crack it open. See? And you're actually eating its gonads.
It's ghoulies like?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Good for
I didn't
him.
Say that in the video. I was like, it's inside.
Loads of protein.
Yeah,
definitely loads
really,
of protein.
Really, really healthy. Yay. Our live show's coming up as well, the 27th.
I'm nothing to wear.
I ordered something actually.
Did you?
Yeah, I got a navy outfit.
Okay.
Just thought it's kind of Christmassy vibe without being too Christmassy.
Yeah.
Something dark.
I need to order something. Sushi next week. What's wrong with me? I do this all the time.
Next week, guy. Oh my God.
Yeah, I do this all the time.
Next Thursday, you give me anxiety.
It'll come together. It'll be fine.
Yeah.
We'll be grand.
So November 27th, which is a Thursday, in UCH Limerick, we have Madison Cawley, Shane McCarthy. We have more special guests as well. We also need confessions for the show. So if you have any mad confessions that you have in life, anything, they're all anonymous. But please send them our way to hellmydrink@goloudnow.com.
Yeah. We won't out you, but we'll just out your confession.
Yeah. You can just sit there and know it's about you, but no one will ever know.
Yeah, you just giggle along with the crowd and you'll be fine.
Yeah, literally. But and we have a few more special guests as well.
I think this will be a good show.
Yeah, it will be. It's going to kind of be, it's the last one before Christmas, I suppose. So it's like,
yeah,
Christmasy vibes. Maybe we'll do a Christmas dance.
We keep saying that. I think we need to try
and I know. Us and Madison.
Yeah.
We need to get our t-shirts.
Santa baby.
The I need heads.
I have mine.
You got it?
Got it.
When?
During the week.
Did you?
I just saw when she said something about a pink packaging. Yeah. She was like, did you get your pink package? I have a pink package at home. And I seen on her story, someone put it up as well.
Maybe.
It's in a plastic bag.
Mm.
You definitely have it.
Really?
Yeah.
But I was just home looking at my packages trying to find it.
And nothing?
Mm. Oh. I need head.
And my mom asked me what it was. Actually, she
how
saw
do you explain
all,
that one.
She
yet?
Saw all these packages, like in my room. She was like, "What's that? What's that?" She's like, "What's this?" And I was like, "Oh, do you remember Madison Cawley?" And she's like, "Yeah." And I was like, "It's a t-shirt." And she was like, "T-shirt of Madison?" And I was like, "No." I was like, "It's like her kind of slogan." And she was like, "What is it?" And I was like, "It just says I need head." And she goes, "Oh, Jesus, I'm going."
Too much.
So when she sees me wearing that now, she'll be like,
ah. We have to wear it on stage, I'd say.
Love
it. This week, we have something very different on the pod. Mm. So we know that we, especially Ellie, loves a bit of true crime. Mm. I am a little bit more on the scared side of the fence. But Go Loud have just released a true crime podcast like nothing you've ever heard before. Mm-hmm.
John Sweetman is the host and he's got one of the most fascinating careers we've ever heard of. John is a former Garda detective and expert crime scene investigator. He spent over 25 years in the Garda Technical Bureau working on some of the country's biggest cases. He's here to bring us inside the mind of an investigator and tell us what really goes on into solving crime. I was bent into what he was telling me.
Yeah, it was very interesting. The handwriting stuff, he mentioned it briefly about like social welfare.
Fraud.
I was like, that's how far they're going to look at a handwriting and like everything, yeah.
God,
me forging my mom's signature when I was in school. Hate to see John coming.
In my homework journal, sign it off. Your mom signed that. Yep. Yeah. She did. Yeah, definitely.
She's seen that for all my ingredients.
I definitely did that in secondary school for years. Actually, I got my mom's signature down to a T for the last like 3 years in school.
Yeah.
So I signed my mom's.
Very handy. Wouldn't recommend them.
No.
So we hope that you enjoy this chat. So John, for anyone who hasn't listened yet, what exactly is Lines of Inquiry about? What makes it different to other true crime podcasts that are out there?
Well, as you say, it's another true crime mm-hmm. podcast. There's certainly a few of them knocking around. But what we hope makes it different is that, you know, the level of authenticity in it, everything is fact checked, you know, so we try to be 100% truthful.
Mm-hmm.
And then with me having been in the Guards for 30 years and also been, you know, attached to the Technical Bureau, we hope it brings more of an insight into what goes on behind, you know, the crime scene tape at some of these scenes where you see, you know, you always see the people in the white suits, but you mightn't necessarily know what goes on.
Yeah. And what they do, yeah.
And, you know, even like some of the cases that we've got for the first season, I was involved directly with a few of them. But even the ones that I'm not involved with, you know, I would know the general kind of procedures that are taking place. And I'm still kind of pinching myself that I'm doing this. It's mad. But like Lines of Inquiry, we just hope to get across, you know, these cases in an interesting way. Like, you know, we are trying to tell stories and also, you know, be mindful of, you know, the victims and the victims' families and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it's all, you know, we're trying to be as good as we can be,
you know. Yeah, it's a different, like, world now that you're in from what you used to do, like, day to day as a crime scene investigator. So what was a day like in that job? Like, what would...
Yeah, well, like, I was in the Bureau, as I say, for 25 years. I spent 10 years in fingerprints. And being in fingerprints means that you can be called out to go to crime scenes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, any day you'd come in, depending on whether it was your turn or not, like, you know, maybe a call would come in, could be for anywhere in the country and, you know, they need a photographer, they need a mapper, ballistics person and a fingerprinter, and then you'd be away, like, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, depending on the scene, you could be gone for several days. And then, even though you're finished up at the crime scene, you're bringing back exhibits with you. So you still have work to do. You still have stuff to, you know, examine and treat. And then you have to search finger marks. And if you've got evidence and all that, you have to prepare charts for court and stuff like that. Yeah. But even if there wasn't call-outs, we would still be receiving exhibits from all over the country for, you know, volume crime like burglaries and stolen cars and all this sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. Like on a daily basis, they'd be coming in. They all have to be treated for, you know, for fingerprints and searched, and as well as, you know, fingerprints lifted from crime scenes by local scenes of crimes officers. So even if you weren't away, you still have a ton of stuff to do, like, you know.
I always wonder about this stupid question, but about the fingerprints. Like, if someone who's never been fingerprinted before, if you catch their fingerprints, how do you find the person?
Yeah. Like, yeah, like,
do they have to be a past, like, criminal for them kind of to be?
Yeah, well, there's various different reasons why somebody might be fingerprinted, and various different acts to be fingerprinted under, you know. And there's powers there for people to be fingerprinted if they're brought in for, you know, different crimes at a Garda station. People can get fingerprinted when they go to prison. Only some of them can be retained for a certain period of time, like certain sets of fingerprints, like prison sets or maybe offences against the State Act sets of fingerprints. They can be kept, you know, whereas other ones have to be destroyed after a period of time. And like what you're saying about like finding fingerprints at a scene and they're belonging to somebody who has never been printed.
Mm.
Okay, you're not going to get a hit. You're not going to get, like, you know, an identification out of it. But those searched marks, like, you know, say fingerprints at a burglary or something, when they're entered on the system as a search, they're retained on the system. So as well as, you know, looking at crime scene marks, all that sort of stuff, every day sets of fingerprints are coming in from all the Garda stations and prisons and stuff like that to be put onto the system.
And you like a match then.
Not only do they check to see if they've already been printed so you can file all those prints together, it also runs a check against the unsolved crime scene marks.
Okay.
So you could get what they call reverse hits then, you know.
Yeah.
If somebody's never been on the system before and they're, say, a prolific burglar and finally they get nabbed for something and their prints go on the system, and you might get a load of reverse hits.
Yeah.
You know?
And track them back to all the past crimes they've done.
Yeah.
It's fascinating, I think. You are an expert in fingerprints, handwriting, and document analysis.
Yeah.
How can you tell something apart, like something so small as the way you write a letter? How can you determine things like that?
How do you identify a suspect from that? Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's not based on, like, you know, you wouldn't be just looking at
their A is different.
Their A.
To that
like
one.
I used to always get cases in where a fella would be like, oh, I think it's this guy because the A looks the same. And I'd be like, well, what about the other 25 letters?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
It's not just how people construct the individual letters. Like a letter will be written differently depending on where it is in a word or maybe depending on what letter it's joined onto, say like a TH and all that sort of stuff, you know? So the whole thing with handwriting is, what you're looking for is to get a good idea of a person's, is it the level of natural variation in somebody's writing.
Okay.
So if you've got enough writing, you know, what I used to do and what most handwriting experts would do is you're sketching out the different variations of each letter. You know, like they might have several different ways of writing a letter. Some of them might be, you know, more unique than others, like, you know. So at the end of that, what you have is a good idea of the degree of variation in somebody's writing. Because we're not machines, we don't write the same way all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and it's different. Every case is different because you might have a really simplistic type of block writing or whatever, or you might have really fluent cursive writing and all this sort of stuff, like, you know. So you can only compare like with like. So if I had block writing that comes in as a, you know, an anonymous letter or something, and the suspect's writing is in joined up, you can't compare them because you're not comparing the same styles.
Yeah.
You know, so what you have to do, what you have to have is, like, you know, you have to have a sufficient amount of writing to compare, and also they have to be in the same style, you know. And to get that, you know, the best possible scenario is you get specimen writing from a suspect, but you get two types of specimen. The first being incidental or course of business writing. So day-to-day, you know, application forms, stuff like that. The beauty about that is it won't be disguised.
It's just the way they naturally write, kind of. Yeah.
But the problem might be that it mightn't be in the style that the question piece of writing is in.
Right.
So you've got that incidental, and then you can also get request specimens, which is where you sit the person down and you tell them what to write and in what style to write it. So then you'll get the right style, but maybe they're nervous or maybe they might try to intentionally disguise it. So the ideal scenario is to get a bit of both and then see if that person's level of, you know, natural variation fits within the that what you've seen in the question, you know. So it's really, it's not about comparing, well, it is about comparing letters, obviously, but it's really more of an analysis of variations.
Of how they write, kind of.
So, like, I found after being, you know, a fingerprint expert, where, you know, if you've got good fingerprint evidence, that's it, it's black and white, it's, there you go. Handwriting was much more, you know, you really had to sell it more. You had to get across why you thought that there was, you know, evidence to say this was written by the same person and all that sort of stuff. And sometimes you just don't have enough material. You can only give a limited opinion or maybe even an inconclusive, you know.
Like your fingerprints are your fingerprints. Yeah. They are black and white.
Yeah.
You can't change them. Whereas writing, I can understand how that might be a little bit harder.
Oh,
to
So sometimes if you're dealing with a case that might be an older case, like, you know, historical, whatever it is, you have to try as best you can to get specimens that are contemporaneous, is that the word? You know, written around the same time.
Okay.
Because
can't
people
compare things like from one end.
Well, especially like with younger people, if you've got something that's, you know, somebody wrote when they were 12 or 13.
Yeah.
It's not going to be
completely different.
Like say every case was different. So unlike fingerprints, handwriting isn't a standalone form of identification evidence. It's a supportive evidence, but it can be equally as good, like, you know,
if it's a good
depend on the case, depend on
and
the period.
Was there any cases that you worked on? I'm sure you've had so many that have really like stuck with you, because I feel like probably as a guard you have to reach some level of like desensitizing yourself to things because you see so much. But was there anything that like stuck with you that you like will never forget?
You know, you always remember your first, you know, dead body, your first murder scene, this type of stuff, you know. But funnily enough, the ones that I remember more were probably the handwriting end of things, you know.
Really?
Now, I was lucky in some regards when I was going out to scenes. Like, I went on far, you know, less scenes than some of my colleagues. Like, it just depended on the way the, you know, the jobs fell or if you were available. Maybe you were in court or something like that. You know, dealing with younger people, like, I was lucky in that, you know, I only one or two cases with kids, you know. I do remember a fatal fire in Limerick, all right, where this fella poured petrol through the letterbox and, you know, set a fire. And there was a good few people in the house because they were having sleepovers and stuff like that. And they all got out, but one little girl was kind of lost in the confusion, and she didn't get out, like, you know. And I remember when we arrived down at the scene, it was very little in it for me because the place was destroyed. Like, you know, you're not going to get fingerprints really. So I was just assisting with the ballistics person and the photographer and that. But we saw out in the garden where, when the fire brigade had cleared out a lot of stuff, like when they come into a house, they're just fecking stuff out windows, you know, and dousing it down. But the mattress was there and she had lain on the mattress and it was just this little patch. You can almost see in the shape of where she'd curled up, like, and she died. She died not long after that. So that kind of stuck with me, even though, you know, I didn't see the poor devil or anything like that, you know. But so that one kind of stuck with me. But some of the handwriting cases, because, you know, somebody's handwriting is very personal. It's a very personal thing, you know. And when you're examining writing, especially, you know the person is dead, like, you know, so. You know, I've done numerous suicide letters and stuff like that.
I was going to say, is the handwriting, you mean like letters left by people, notes left by people?
Yeah. Now, sometimes it might be just a short scrawl thing, you know, maybe there's alcohol or drugs involved, but other times you could have pages of stuff.
Really?
And really neat and thought out, and they've thought about everything, and they're, you know, what to do with this, what to do with that, what to do with the family dog, all that sort of stuff. And then you know, like, just after they finish this, that they're after killing themselves. You know, although no crime has been disclosed, the writing still has to be proven. So you get the question note or whatever, and you get some specimen material belonging to the person, because, you know, it might be needed in a coroner's court or something like that, you know. And I did a lot of those, and I did one there. I can't remember the names of them. It's not that long ago now, but where this fella killed his wife and his two kids. But he, I was examining this letter written by one of the kids, which was, she was 12, I think. Yeah. And the way it was done was, it was made to seem as if the mother, who didn't have any English, had dictated this letter to the kid, saying that she was feeling suicidal and all this sort of stuff. So that when they were found, you know, people would think, oh, the mother killed the kids and then herself.
Wow.
But it was actually the father that had dictated this letter.
I remembered that. Was that not that long ago?
No, it's only a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
I should remember their names, but I just can't. But he had dictated the letter to the little girl, and, you know, I was ready to go to court for that. You know, obviously there was another mountain of evidence, but he killed himself in custody then. So he didn't get the chance, you know. But like, those ones stick with you. Yeah. And another one as well, girl up in, I think it was Donegal a couple of years ago, Jasmine McMonagall, and she was beaten to death by her boyfriend. But she had written a letter to him just a couple of weeks prior to that, saying she wasn't going to stand for it anymore. And she was being really strong about it, like, you know. And, you know, then he killed her, like, you know. And I have had the letter there, and you're kind of reading. It's almost like it's like a bit of a time machine, because you're in a snapshot into this person's
brain
really at that time, you know, like. And whereas the content of writing generally isn't of any importance to me as, you know, a handwriting expert from an identification point of view, you can't help but, you know, absorb some of the content, like that stuff, you know.
Of course.
But yeah, like, those are the ones that kind of stuck with me a bit more, because, like, I know what you're saying about being desensitized and stuff like that. Yeah, there is, you know, to some extent, like with anybody working
protect yourself, kind of, like, a
little bit. Like anybody working in the emergency services, or you know, nurses and doctors and all that. You know, you do get that initial shock to the system when you go into a nasty scene, but very quickly the work takes over. You're there to do a job.
Yes.
And, you know, that's what you have to do, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, you could be at that scene for several days. Okay, the body won't be there for several days, but, you know, it's just, you get on with it, like, you know. And I know in a lot of police forces around the world, or forensic units, people are only allowed to serve a certain amount of time in case they get, you know, too much of this stuff,
pressure,
or whatever, like, you know.
Okay.
But here, like, certainly in the technical bureau, that didn't, you know, that wasn't a factor. And the beauty about it was, you had, like, so many people there with decades of experience.
Yeah.
So you were always picking something up and learning something from somebody.
Someone,
like, you know.
Yeah.
And it might be just a little tiny thing, and it'd stick with you, like, you know. Whereas if you're constantly rehashing staff every 3 or 5 years and retraining them, but it was the amount of, you know, combined experience, which was great, like, you know.
And then for the listeners, obviously, who listen to true crime podcasts, I feel like they're only getting bigger. Why do you think are people so, like, drawn to that and, like, love listening to true crime?
I'm obsessed.
And hearing about
it.
Ellie listens to it to go to sleep.
Yeah.
If you looked at my YouTube, you'd think I'm a serial killer.
Yeah.
Yeah, me and my sister, I swear to God.
Oh, you should see my internet search history. It's unbelievable.
I actually think the guards would be called if you looked at my search history sometimes.
I don't know. Like, I mean, and it's not going to go away anytime soon.
It's
only
getting bigger, if anything, I think.
You know, somebody said to me there recently that, you know, it's, you know, the human condition, and people are interested in extremes of that, you know, and seeing what some people will do, like, you know. And especially then with the, you know, the true crime stuff, where you have, you know, actual people that were involved in the cases and stuff like that. It's just fascinating, like, you know.
Yeah, that's what I think it is.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, I think it's so outlandish in, like, in a normal wired brain.
Yeah.
That's why we find it so interesting. Yeah. It's like, I could never, ever imagine, like, obviously Jesus never imagined doing that.
Or even thinking of anything like that.
But that's why we're so intrigued by it, is because we're just like, what? Like, how?
And I think maybe it does, is there a bit of it in it that, like, you know, if you look at these things with terrible stuff happening to people, you're kind of like, well, it's not me. Like, you know, you feel a little bit better about yourself because your life hasn't been, you know, upended or whatever.
I don't know.
It's just,
it has to be science behind it somewhere.
I do think something, it kind of unlocks new fears in me, though, when I hear certain things. Yeah, because I'm like, God, I never even thought of that being able to happen. Yeah. And now it's like a new thing where it's like, that's in my head.
That can happen to anyone.
Yeah,
well, I watch a lot of them myself now, but only the procedural ones where you've got, you know, police or whatever talking about what they did mixed in with, you know, family and survivors and stuff like that. But I don't watch any of the CSI stuff or anything.
No.
Did you watch Jeffrey Dahmer?
I did,
I loved that. I wish I could delete that out of my brain.
Jeffrey Dahmer was good, but I thought the most recent one, Ed Gein.
Oh, did you like that?
I thought it was brilliant.
I couldn't get into it.
Yeah, and no, you see, what I picked up on it was I'm a mad movie fan.
Okay.
So with the Alfred Hitchcock stuff and Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
Signs of the Lambs, all tied into it.
I loved it,
I did watch it, but I couldn't. Something about it, I was kind of like, I'm finding it really difficult to. I do like all the true crime stuff, though. I like seeing people. I like seeing. Jeez, I should be in the. I love seeing, like, the real things. Behind it, I find all that fascinating.
The other one of that, the Menendez brothers one.
Oh, yeah. I didn't watch that either. I just get scared.
It was good. Yeah.
Yeah, they're interesting ones.
You recently had an episode out for the Midlands letter case. For people who haven't heard about that yet, what is that?
It was one of these things that nobody heard about, you know, probably because, you know, there was no real kind of overt crime. Thanks be to God, involved in it until, you know, he was finally caught. But, you know, that kind of snowballed because it just started with, like, I got a letter in to examine just any other day at the office or whatever. But this one had 23 pages in it and it was constant, really, really, you know, explicit sadism stuff. He was going to, you know, abduct, torture, rape, kill schoolgirls, college girls, all this sort of stuff. And, like, to keep that up for over 20-something pages and, you know, listing all the implements he'd gathered in his torture chamber and all this sort of stuff.
Wait, was this letter sent to you?
Well, it came to me to examine.
To examine, yeah.
That one was originally sent to the Athlone IT.
What?
And, you know, there was nothing else, like, I couldn't do anything else with it. I checked it for indentations in case there was any, if, you know, invisible indentations from previous pages. Sometimes you can bring stuff up that can help in identifying the writer or whatever. But nothing happened with that. It got sent for DNA, for fingerprints, but like that, no hits on the system and no suspects writing. So there wasn't much else I could do with it. But about 2 months later, two more letters came in, and I think one of them, if not both, one or both of them had been sent to a Garda station, like actually directly to a Garda station. But they came in for examination, and the minute I opened up the evidence bags, I was like, oh, I know this writing. You know, I know this thing. And I went back to the earlier case, and I was like, yeah. So now I had three letters, but they'd all come in from three different Garda in three different Garda stations. So they probably weren't aware of each other, you know. So, again, still no suspects. So when I was sending out my reports, I put into it, you know, please see that this case is also connected with this case, and gave the other Garda's names and stuff like that so they could kind of start working together, you know. Mm-hmm. But it started, it like, all through that was 2015 I got the first one. I got the second two early 2016, and all the way through 2016 and into 2017, like, the letters kept coming, you know, and like that 20, 30, 40 pages long, each
but
of them.
No crime ever done apart from the letters.
Yeah, but you see, we didn't, like, he had all these things in the letters saying that he had raped all these people and he'd abused his daughter and his niece, and he had all his cable ties and his shovels and saws and meat hooks and chains, everything ready, you know, for abducting. And he even had like listed out the times it would take to drive from A to B, how long it would take to find a suitable girl.
Basically had it all planned, it all just ready without to, following through.
All ready to go. Like,
and it was just the threat of it, obviously.
It was the threat of it. But then after that third letter, I thought to myself that this guy is so prolific that maybe we've got more of these here that I'm not aware of.
Yeah.
So I went back through all the records. We kept handwritten records of everything going back decades. And eventually got a case from 2004, which was 12 years prior, and more writing like that. Same guy, same writer. But this stuff was found in a makeshift hide or a den out in the woods down near Tullamore. He had a wheelie bin partially buried in the ground, wrapped in plastic, and he had his cable ties and his saw and his hammer.
In the bin?
In the bin. He had a notice board pinned up on a tree nearby. This is like out in the woods. You'd never see it unless you knew where it was. Wow. You know, notice board covered in photographs of women and stuff from pornographic magazines and stuff like that. There was a biscuit tin in the bin with more of this writing, you know. So I was able to say, yeah, that's this guy. It's him again. And he had all sorts of, you know, adult nappies, everything, ropes, stuff like that. And, you know, like then the question was, like, has he acted out on any of this stuff yet? Mm. Or what's the story? But he seemed to be escalating from 2015 into 2016 and 17. And, you know, at this stage, the guards knew that they were aware of all the other letters. So it was kind of a central investigation then in around Tullamore. And they started to identify suspects and forward handwriting specimens to me. But no joy, nothing was happening with it, you know. And it kept going on like that. And I don't really want to give away the end. Although it's been out a couple of weeks.
Yeah. Don't give away the end because I'm putting this on the car on the way home.
Yeah, but the gas thing about it was, like, you know, nobody heard about it. And then even when we were putting the script together for it, trying to find information on it and on the eventual culprit was nearly impossible. It just wasn't out there. We eventually got it in some old newspaper archives from the locality where he was named and whatever happened with courts and stuff like that. So we could then name him, like, you know. But yeah, like it's just something that it was the biggest kind of continuous handwriting case I was ever involved in. And even like I've spoken to some of the guards involved in the investigation. And even now, like, you know, a few years later, which is nearly 10 years later, they say it's the one that, you know, it was just so weird. It was eerie,
yeah,
you know. Eerie. And these would be seasoned guards, like, involved in very high-profile cases. But they reckon, like, you know, that this one was just, a weird one, you know. And, you know, I've often done massive big handwriting cases that usually involve signatures if you're talking social welfare fraud or stuff like that. But this, the amount of writing in it, it was just the volume of it and the fact that it went on for so long and it was... The content was so disturbing. Mm. You know, I've had cases of letters going on over a number of years, but it's usually more on the nuisance level. Okay, it's a you know, the people receiving them wouldn't say that, but you know, not the really, really nasty stuff. Like this is nasty stuff. I was only read over some of the copies of it there recently, and I was like, Jesus, like, you know, because he was referencing other people as well. Like, he was referencing other girls that had gone missing, Deirdre Jacob, Fiona Pender. He was bragging that he had killed Fiona Pender. He had pictures cut out of two other Irish women that had been killed abroad, Karen Buckley and Jill Marr, and saying that what they suffered would have been mild compared to what he'll be doing to his victims and this kind of stuff, you know. But yeah, like fairly early on, we kind of reckoned that he had to be an older guy, you know, like myself, because people don't write that much anymore, you know? And probably...
That wouldn't even have been something I would have thought of.
Yeah, but probably not tech savvy either, like cutting stuff out of newspapers and magazines and sticking them in, you know? But it took a while to get him and a little bit of luck involved in it as well, but it was great. It was a great case to see to the end, like, you know.
But if someone hasn't done a crime, I need to listen to it, but like if they haven't done it and they've written all them letters, how can they get much time? Like if they've just, all they've done is written and what they are going to do or what they maybe have done.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm not giving it away or anything like that, but he got a substantial sentence.
Oh, he did? Okay.
For a number of reasons, because he was talking about doing all this horrible stuff to, you know, underage girls.
Yeah.
And some of the material he had underage girls in it. Oh, God. So then you're straight into the charges to do with child pornography, which are, you know,
which is huge,
fairly strict, as well as charges under the Postal Services Act by sending and, you know, sending and distributing obscene stuff.
Yeah.
But those psychiatric reports done on him and all this sort of stuff. Like, so he got a hefty sentence. Like, I was even surprised at the sentence he got.
So you're obviously revisiting cases through the podcast that you've worked on. Is it weird going back and also like finding out new information that you might not even have known at the time? And how was it revisiting them in general?
Yeah, like it's been very interesting. Like going back to the ones that I was involved in, obviously, and you know, I have pretty good memory for things. And then, like all guards, you know, a lot of written notes and stuff from the time. But in going back to those cases that, you know, I was directly involved in, I've also got the team, you know, the Goal Out team, looking into stuff as well and doing fact checks and whatnot, and maybe finding out little bits and pieces that I didn't know, like, you know, maybe the background to the victims and stuff like that, you know. So like, people working, you know, my side of the crime scene tape are involved in the incident and stuff like that, and maybe not as much into the bigger picture of the person and, you know, and finding out all these little things has been fascinating. Plus, you know, as accurate as I'd like to think my memory is, you know, everybody's memory is fallible or whatever. So I have been speaking to some former colleagues of mine that are now retired, and they've come up with little bits and pieces, little nuggets of information that are great as well. And they mightn't be like case breaker things, but they're things like, oh, geez, yeah, I do remember that. Do you remember how hard it was to take that photograph of that finger mark? And I was like, oh, yeah. And, you know,
it unlocks a memory.
It unlocks a memory. Yeah. And it's brilliant, like, you know, going back to these things, because, you know, at the time, like, you know, when you're working these cases and whatnot, like I say, you're kind of desensitized in some sense, and you're constantly thinking of the end goal, which is getting your evidence right in case you're needed in court. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have that pressure anymore.
No, yeah.
So I'm free to dig into stuff and, you know, go off down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the up and coming episodes in Lines of Inquiry are like that, you know. They're cases that I haven't been involved in.
Wow.
Maybe only in the periphery or something like that. And there's one or two of them that they've just got their hooks into me, like, you know, ones that I hadn't really known about because they're well before my time, you know. And I'm like that Googling away, like, you know, there's internet search history, you know, about what's left of a body after 30 years and all this sort of stuff. Like, but I'm finding it great. Like, and it also brings back that, you know, when you're in the job, you kind of take it for granted what you're doing. Mm. But when you step away from it, then I'm retired now 2 years, you kind of say that, yeah, what you did do was important, you know.
100%.
You know, it was important.
Is it a different kind of outlook, like, now that you're retired? Like, is it a different going back looking at it rather than being in the midst of it, kind of?
Not really. And I'd say, like, most other ex-bureau people would be the same, like, you know, like the guards in general.
You'd still have that mentality.
You still have it. Like, you know, you've had it for years. There's certain lingo, certain way of talking about things, whatnot, which is great because you can meet any mule, as we call each other, and strike up a conversation and start bitching about the same things. You don't know each other. You know?
Yeah, you all call each other mules.
Oh, my God.
You know, because it was great.
All the lingo now, sure.
Because I rang, I was like that. I was trying to do some research for one of the other team members on one of the up-and-coming episodes. And I was ringing around guard stations, and I rang one guard station there last week, and I said, how are you doing? I was a member myself, like, you know, and I'm doing a podcast with Go Loud. And oh, he says, oh, jeez, I was listening to that on the way in this morning.
So
straight away, brilliant. I knew I was on the pig's back.
Yeah.
And, you know, he's going to do his best to get back to me with a bit of info, you know. But it's great like that, because for, you know, up until I got involved with the podcast, it was almost, that's it, it's gone. You know, yeah. That 30 years is gone.
Yeah.
But now it's kind of come back a little bit, you know.
It's still a part of your, because it was such a big part of your life, yeah, so it still is, yeah, now, yeah.
And it's good to kind of get back into, yeah, it, you know.
And for anyone of our listeners who wants to listen, where can they listen to Lines of Inquiry and what can they expect?
Yeah, well, to say it's a new Go Loud original. It's on Spotify. It's on Go Loud site itself or anywhere you get your podcasts, you know. I think now tomorrow the fourth episode is out and we have four more to go in season one. As I say, a couple of them are more historic cases, mm-hmm, and some of them people might be aware of. But yeah, we just hope to put them out and do them as, you know, do the stories justice, like, you know, and keep it entertaining at the same time.
Yeah.
But yeah.
John, thank you so much for coming on. Well,
thanks for having me.
So interesting. Thank you so much. So Red Flag Radar is when we send our listeners send in red flags or things they think are red flags, mm-hmm, and we can be the judge if they are or not. So the first one is, our own relationship is really healthy, but he doesn't put any effort in with my family to the point he can come across rude. He's not close to his family, so I'm not sure if he just doesn't get it.
He's not close to his family. Okay. Is it a red flag?
Red flag. I feel like when someone's like not
close with your family.
You know, if they don't make an effort and like your family think they're rude, then that's a red flag.
A big red flag.
Yeah.
To even not like try, do you know,
yeah,
what I mean? Like you're not saying you have to be best friends with your family, but to not even
make an effort
to the point that you literally come across as rude.
Yeah.
We're saying red.
He's not close to his family.
No.
So maybe like that's just...
He doesn't know how to be close to
his family.
He doesn't
know, you know, or, you know, I'd say it's a tiny red flag, but
yeah,
I don't think so. Like, if he's not close to his family, then probably just the way he's used to it.
The way
he
is wired that way.
Yeah.
John, you're nicer than us.
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah. We're brutal when it comes to this. We already kind of touched on this one a little bit. We'll give it to the listeners again. So we've lived in our house for 3 years and the man still doesn't know how to use the washing machine.
Oh, that's not a red flag at all. That's
John's gonna be biased here now and say they're all green.
But you're living together, like, so what's the problem? You know, like, I mean, I didn't know how to use the washing machine up until about 3 years ago.
Stop that.
Well, it's all these settings. You can't just push one button. You know, and then what happens is there, my daughter cuts the labels off all her clothes because she doesn't like the labels on them, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't know
how to wash it.
No, I know what's dark and what's white.
Yeah.
But then when it comes to the dryer, she's had the labels cut off them.
And everything's
so
shrunk, everything's this size.
You know.
Oh, God.
Has he been told to see? If he's not been told how to use it.
But should he not have initiative to learn himself?
But he's probably doing everything else. Like, he'd probably bring the bins out. And
well, yeah, if the jobs are split and he doesn't, that's not his job. Because I think jobs should be split. I don't think it should all be left as one person.
Absolutely, yeah.
But if that's not his job, I wouldn't know how to use it either then. If that wasn't, if my job was the dishwasher and the bins, I wouldn't know how to use the washing machine.
Really?
I only learned when I moved into my apartment.
Did you?
Yeah. Mom, I was in the washing.
No, but see,
it's hard. There is a lot of buttons.
If his partner is like me, I'm now that I do the washing, and I'm obsessed with putting the wash on.
Oh.
And my wife's always telling me, there's not enough. And I'm like, oh, but we'll do it anyway.
We'll do it, yeah.
You know, whereas if his partner's like that and is constantly putting the wash on, and he's just like, well, she's going to do it. I don't need to do it.
Yeah.
So no, so I don't need it. It's a red flag.
Okay. Last one. We've been seeing each other for 6 weeks and he's trying to plan a holiday with me for next year. It feels a bit too soon.
Nah.
Not too soon?
No.
I wouldn't. What if you don't want to be with them next year?
It's a better way to get to know somebody.
Not for next year, though.
No.
I think.
No, I don't think so. It's too.
So he's trying to, like, trap her in?
Yeah. Yeah, that's a red flag.
Like, for a year in advance. Like, if it was maybe the following month.
Mm, yeah.
That might be okay.
Yeah. But you can't see that far ahead a year. Like,
no.
You know.
And then you have a booked and paid and you don't like him anymore.
Then you're stuck.
You can't really know if you love someone after, like, or really like someone after 6 weeks enough to see the next year with them.
For the next year.
Because he could be love bombing her.
Mm. Yeah.
It's giving love bomb.
Trying to trap her.
Yeah. If it's for a weekend away, that's coming up soon, different. But if he's planning a whole holiday for next summer.
No, I don't.
And if he's. Run the other way.
Yeah. If we see you next year, how many further years down the line is he looking in? He probably has their whole 10 year
plan.
God, their 10 year anxiety plan going ahead.
Yeah, he might have a hole dug out the back too. Like,
oh,
you know.
God.
Oh God.
Yeah, red. We're saying red. John, thanks so much for joining us.
No, that's grand. Thanks.
So Phone a Friend has now been moved to our bonus episode on Monday. So make sure you pop over there to hear the amazing advice that you guys always give. Mm-hmm. And a final reminder to get your tickets for Limerick, November 27th. We're so excited to see you all there. It's going to be a night to remember.
I think it'll be a wild one. I think I got a few messages saying, are we going out after it? So
yeah, let us know where to go.
Let us know.
Although after the weekend, I'm like,
yeah, I never want to see a drink.
But we will, obviously. Next week, it'll be all forgotten. So you get your tickets now on uch.ie. And we'll see you on Monday.
See you then.
Love you.
Bye.
Subscribe to this podcast for free on the Go Loud app.